This is a second edition. Now, is there is this an updated version of some sort, or is
Yes. The first edition was published in 2014, and what that edition primarily had was my interviews and photographs of the 45 people that I talked to on the street. And there was some text, you know, that bookended those photographs and interviews. But I always felt that the book lacked a little more heft. By that, I mean that it needed, in addition to that, a much fuller description of the causes and solutions to homelessness. So the second edition really added about almost 100 pages in which I focused on those two issues.
But the interviews, photographs, that all remains the same then?
Yes, that all remains the same.
We are talking this morning with Dr. Okun. The book, again, it's called Silent Voices. It's people with mental disorders on the street. How did you decide to make this so personal?
Well, after I left my position as chief, I was walking down the street to my car, and it was a cold and really rainy night. And just before I got into my car, I saw this little woman kind of huddled up in rags, trying to protect herself from the rain. And I just couldn't get her out of my mind for weeks afterwards. And I wondered how in the world she could bear night after night after night such, you know, such adversity. So I decided I would start to talk to people who were homeless and mentally ill and actually ask them about their lives. So that was the original motivation, that I just wanted to know about it. And I couldn't really get that close when I was a doctor in the hospital. So I began to talk to people who were obviously homeless and mentally ill. And at first, I thought that they would just blow me away because, you know, I was just some dude with a knapsack and a camera and none of the authority that I had in the hospital. So I, you know, I was quite anxious, actually. And I had a lot of difficulty going up to the first couple of people because I just expected they would, as I said, blow me off and refuse to talk to me. But I found the opposite. They just seemed genuinely pleased that I was interested in their lives. And most of these people had been neglected as children and continued to feel invisible as people on the street. And seeing that I was genuinely interested in their lives seemed to mean a lot to them, and they were willing to talk to me. And secondly, I expected to find people with tough outer shells who were going to be very difficult to connect with. Instead, I found people who were exquisitely sensitive and very willing to talk to me with surprising candor and intensity about very personal, intimate, and often shameful aspects of their lives. Most of the people I interviewed had tears in their eyes during much of the interviews. I also expected them to blame their homelessness on something else, but in fact, they tended to blame themselves, wrongly in my opinion, which I can explain, but that's what they did. Mm-hmm. So the reason that I turned this into a book was that I was so struck by their stories that I wanted to share them in the photographs with the public. I wanted to share the public a view of these people as real human beings, beyond their rags, their carts, and their strange behaviors. And I thought that by giving them a voice in the public domain, I could convey their essential humanity as a counterweight, you might say, to the fear and the hostility and the blame and indifference with which they're generally seen and treated. Because as long as we don't see them as real people, we'll never be able to identify or connect with them, and we'll continue to dehumanize them. And if we carry this view into the political arena, we'll continue to convey to our political leaders that we don't really care about these people, despite all our hand-wringing, and that we won't hold them accountable for abandoning them, and the problem will never be solved. I came to believe that humanizing them was really the foundation for political action, and only political action will push our leaders into knowing that we insist that they stop nibbling around the edges of this problem and really take action to solve it, because it can be solved. It's an imminently solvable problem, and there's good evidence for this.
Silent Voices is the name of the book. We're talking with Dr. Robert Okun. Let's talk about, I guess, when did this start? Is there a beginning point? Is there a point where we suddenly realize that this has become a crisis? Or has it always been there? And as you say, sometimes we just don't see it.
Well, I think it's gotten worse. There's no question about it. I believe that it really started with the whole process of deinstitutionalization, in which state governments, in order to save money primarily, dumped thousands of people who were mentally ill and quite impaired out of the hospitals. They dumped 600,000 people. I mean, can you imagine that? 600,000 people they dumped out of the hospital onto the streets with no services, no treatment, no housing. Well, where are these people going to go? I mean, where they went was into the streets. And to this day, 70 years after this, governments have still failed to create the kind of mental health and substance abuse services that could really help treat these people. And the result is that 40% of the homeless population is serious and untreated psychiatric disorders. And when the drug epidemic emerged in the 70s, governments at all levels failed to both stem the flow of drugs into the country and establish substance abuse services that could help people who became addicted. So more people, as a result of these failures, slipped onto the streets. And then more fundamentally, and this is something that I think the public just doesn't really have much idea of, the taxation policies created by the federal government really contributed to this problem in a major way, because the taxation policies created huge disparities of wealth in this society, allowing 10% of the population to amass a huge amount of wealth, more than 50% of the bottom half of the population combined. And this set the stage for a huge increase in the homeless population. For the people at the very bottom of the income ladder were left with nothing. I mean, you could put it this way. You could say that government basically overstuffed and gorged the richest segment of the population, which inevitably meant that it had to starve the poorest segment. And the homeless population are the true casualties of this. But instead of helping to soften their poverty, the government aggravated it further by keeping welfare payments, on which these people depend, so low as to keep them impoverished forever. And the federal government could have offset the impact of these policies by creating a robust safety net so that the casualties wouldn't fall off into the streets, often with one little financial reverse. But it didn't do this. It did the opposite. Instead, the government slashed the already limited federal support for low-income housing and justified this by promoting a completely phony theory of economics, the trickle-down economic theory, that pushed still more people into the street. So that was, I would say, the major contribution of state and federal governments. And you can see that there's a compounding effect. Each policy compounded the effects of the previous one. But state governments and city governments also contributed to the problem. For example, city governments often created incentives that encouraged real estate developers to convert low-income housing into condominiums that poor people couldn't possibly afford. In New York City alone, this led to the loss of 100,000 low-income apartments. Well, where were these people going to go that lived in these apartments? Many became homeless, and so the homeless population increased still further. And then city governments gave tax breaks and other incentives to big tech companies, wooing them to settle within their borders and then failing to tax them for gobbling up the housing supply with their high-paid employees. So we now have a situation in which there's simply not enough low-income housing for all the people that needed it. You know, this has been compared to a kind of a game of musical chairs in which when the music stops, somebody is left standing, and that somebody is usually fragile and mentally ill and becomes homeless. So I know this is a lot to digest, and I'd be happy to discuss the specific solutions that government must take. But I describe the contributions of government to creating the problem in order to challenge a kind of myth that homelessness just happened almost by itself as part of the natural order of things. But there's nothing natural about it. It didn't just happen. Governments contributed to creating and maintaining the problem. And if we don't see this, we'll fail to hold them responsible to solve it. You know, we're lucky to live in a democracy, as fragile as it seems right now, and we need to use it to force change. And we also need to remember that the government is not some abstract entity separate from us. The government is us. It responds to our pressures. It responds to our views. And as long as we continue to hold the view of homeless people as freeloaders, as long as we continue to dehumanize them, then we'll be basically telling our political leaders that it's okay to abandon them. And if we fail to exert pressure, we'll be living with this problem for the next 100 years, and we'll only have ourselves to blame.
Well, without getting into too many things, because you can't solve things overnight, what are some of your solutions that you think could help with the homeless population, and also specifically those with the mental illness?
Well, you know, it's not rocket science. Homeless people need homes. Mentally ill people need treatment. And government is the only entity in our society with all of its taxing power, especially at the federal and state levels, that have the funds to provide low-income housing and to provide real treatment. And you might say, well, so how's that going to happen? Well, it's only going to happen if we as citizens push our leaders to make it happen. But it's not complicated. People need homes and they need treatment. And we know from experience that when this is provided, that homelessness can be greatly diminished. And what's the evidence for this? It's not just a theory on my part. If you look at the homeless vets, the federal government, starting in the Obama administration, was so embarrassed by the way that it was really deserting these vets, both in their hospitals, the VA hospitals, and also on the streets, that a lot of political pressure got generated to do something about this. And the government quickly moved in and began to provide housing and mental health treatment for these people. And in a 10-year period, homelessness among vets decreased by 41%. I mean, that's huge. And then there's other evidence. the city of Houston, if you can believe it, had a very, very high, very high homeless population. And the government decided that it was going to focus on people with chronic homelessness. And since then, largely using the same strategy, providing low-cost housing and real substance abuse and mental health treatment, it had moved 25,000 homeless people into apartments and houses. And the overwhelming majority of them have remained housed after 2 years. So the number of homeless people in Houston has been cut by 63% since 2011. How did they do this? Basically, by prioritizing this, the solution of this problem in deeds, not just words, combining funds from various levels of government and reorganizing and streamlining its agencies to provide housing and treatment for these people. You know, politicians stopped talking and began acting, and the mayor was crucial in this process.
Talking this morning with Dr. Robert Okun. The book is called Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. This is second edition. When I want to get back sort of to those personal stories of those homeless, because you talk about making them being seen and sort of understanding their stories. When you were talking with them, though, did you not find, or it seems like a lot of times with homeless people, they seem to be very resourceful. There's a component of the of a individual or whatever. They've somehow been able to survive even in those circumstances. What did you learn from them related to that at all?
Well, I think your word survive is exactly the right word, because they're not doing much more than just surviving. And, you know, I think what we don't see is that the mortality rate among this population is very high. So, yeah, they survive until they stop surviving. They survive by, you know, often pulling food out of garbage cans and sleeping on heating grates. And, I mean, that's survival, but it's not living. And, you know, when the public passes them, they often think to themselves, well, these guys are freeloaders. I mean, they're just freeloaders, and they could deal with their problems if they really wanted to. Like, why don't they get a job, for God's sakes? And to those people, I say, okay, imagine yourself in rags, pushing a cart around with all your worldly possessions, you know, with a tin cup in the back of your pocket, not having showered for a week because there's no place to shower, kind of smelling. You go into a prospective employer and you say, can I have a job? And the employer looks at you and thinks, you must be kidding. But he says, okay, maybe give me an address that I can contact you at and I'll get back to you. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, these people don't have addresses. If they had addresses, they wouldn't be in the situation that they're in. So to say, oh, just get a job, it's just a convenient myth that we use to console ourselves for the fact that we're letting these people just struggle.
Any stories, if not all of them, really stick with you even a decade later that you encountered and what you, in that moment that you spent time, even a couple minutes with some of these people?
Yeah, well, one guy sticks out, a guy who I had breakfast with every month and really got to know. He had a mother. He's a real poster child for people who are in this situation, because most of the people that I interviewed anyway, you know, had been neglected and abused as children, began to take drugs in adolescence to kind of try to soften the pain of their abuse and neglect. You know, and then entered entered adulthood with no employable skills, and a little reverse, and they fell off into the street because they were so fragile and so vulnerable psychologically. And many of these people had a genetic predisposition to mental illness. So that was, you know, another stroke of bad luck. Well, the one person this guy was telling you about that I had breakfast with every week, he grew up in a family in which his mother was completely psychotic and was institutionalized in mental hospitals repeatedly. You know, she often took a butcher knife and tried to kill her husband. And this guy, who, as a child, would lay awake at night terrified that she would come in and kill him. Well, he managed to get through school and became a garbage collector, like his father. And this job was incredibly important to him. I mean, his whole self-esteem was wrapped around it. Well, unfortunately, you know, some pot was discovered in a routine survey of his urine, and he was fired. And he became very depressed, stopped eating, couldn't get out of bed, and then began to take drugs to really to medicate himself out of his depression. But of course, this only made things worse, and he lost his apartment, and he lost his fiancée, and off into the streets he went, where he spent the next 10 years sleeping on a heating grate, having lost all of his teeth because the grime of the streets just makes good dental care impossible. And, you know, when you pass people who are homeless on the street, a lot of them don't have teeth for this reason. He told me, I will not smile because if I do, people will see I have no teeth. He was deeply ashamed of it. And I asked him, well, look, why are you so ashamed of it? I mean, it's a tragedy, not something to be ashamed of. He said, well, you know, if you have a big nose, people just assume you were born with it. They don't blame you for it. But if you don't have teeth, you know, it shows you're a real screw up. You've really failed in some major way to adapt to your life. He also was longing for a romantic relationship, but he said, I won't even go there because as soon as a woman kisses me, she'll feel my gums and she'll be disgusted and she'll turn away. So, you know, I'm giving some of these gritty vignettes because when you said, well, these people survive. Yeah, these people survive. But the pain and suffering of their lives, you know, gets kind of covered up just because they managed to survive. Well, this guy got lucky. He had one of his last teeth infected. It became abscessed, and the infection traveled to his heart. He was hospitalized for over 100 days for a cost to the taxpayer of about $200,000. But, you know, which, by the way, we can talk about if you want, but leaving people homeless is very expensive for society, much more expensive than giving them treatment and housing. But we can go back to that. So he was in the hospital, and one of the case managers or social workers that I had hired, I met him in the hospital and, you know, kind of seduced him into treatment, I would say. She saw him every day for a year and, you know, kept pushing him to give up his drugs. She finally was able to get housing for him, miraculously. And when I met him, he had some low-cost housing, but he was still on drugs. And I asked him, look, what do you see for your life going forward? I mean, are you going to keep this thing up forever? And he said, well, you know, what I'd really love is a kitten. And so I took him to an animal shelter, and, you know, we picked out a kitten. He took the kitten home, and a week later, he stopped using drugs. And I asked him, well, how did that, I mean, what happened? How did you all of a sudden just kind of stop almost cold turkey? He said, well, it was the love, in a way, that my social worker kept showing me by being so committed to me, plus the fact that now this kitten, I had something to live for, and I realized I couldn't take care of the kitten and keep taking drugs at the same time. So having something to live for, he was able to give up his drugs, and lo and behold, he's now working.
Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street is the name of the book. It's second edition with a lot more information about the problem, what could be solved, how things could be better, and what we really need to do. It's a good read for people to look for, kind of seeing the stories of those people that, you, as you said, are sometimes invisible to us. Dr. Robert Okun joining us, leading psychiatrist, world-recognized expert on human rights for the mentally disabled. We appreciate the talk this morning, and thank you for sharing the information. Hope people get a book and kind of understand those people on the street that they sometimes pass by, and what maybe we as individuals can do to help. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.